Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. This hour, it seems like tech is all about AI these days, and you may have heard about China's new AI app, DeepSeek. We'll unpack the buzz and explore why it matters to us here in the Bay Area. Plus, if Trump's new immigration policies are leaving you feeling uncertain, we'll talk with experts who will tell us what's changing, how you can stay informed, and what you can do to reach out to others for support and advice. And later, we'll hear from Jenna Ann Miller. She's the author of The Phenom's Wife, How a Caregiver Lost and Found Herself in Her Family's Trauma. It's a memoir that began as blog entries that she wrote while her husband was in a coma. But first, AI has dominated those tech headlines. It's an industry that the Bay Area is relying upon to lift its economy. However, the introduction of DeepSeek has changed the conversation. According to experts, DeepSeek has the potential to revolutionize big data analysis, but the most recent version of the platform has also raised concerns about privacy and whether this is the killer app that some said it might be. Here to help us make sense of what is going on and how to differentiate those facts from the hype, it's Charles Rollet. He's a senior reporter at TechCrunch. Welcome to State of the Bay, Charles.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Yeah. Well, let's start with the basics, Charles. For people who have not heard about DeepSeek, what is it and why has it been generating so much attention?
So DeepSeek is a Chinese company that does this a chatbot very similar to ChatGPT. It's like a advanced AI chatbot. You can kind of ask it whatever you want. And it really blew up on the scene in Silicon Valley and in the US last week with its latest model called R1. And it climbed at the top of the Apple App Store, and it really got widespread adoption in the US. And it's quite notable because it's the first time a Chinese AI app gets that much attention and adoption in the US.
Have you used it?
Yes, I've used it extensively. And I've even used it starting from a few months ago before it became a really big deal. And I was mostly testing it to see its censorship. And I did notice the app is heavily censored, basically. Yeah.
Well, I think you're moving around a little bit there. How is it censored? What did you find when you used it? And what are people saying about that?
Right. I mean, the thing is, with because it's based in People's Republic of China, DeepSeek has to follow very strict laws in China about, you know, content. And so if you ask it, for example, what happened in Tiananmen Square in 1989, DeepSeek will say, I can't answer that. But if you ask it about any controversial historical issue in the US, it'll very quickly give you a detailed and thorough answer. So it definitely censors strictly according to the Chinese government's view. But what's made it really go viral in the US is its answers on other topics, I would say, like coding, math, and other things.
So maybe on more less subjective topics, it's the same. Is it the same as a ChatGPT experience, or is it somehow better then?
I would say that's a great question. So I think what made DeepSeek really go viral is that it offers a very user-friendly user experience, and it's similar to ChatGPT in that way. And what they also did was that they integrated this kind of new technology called reasoning. They didn't invent it. It's been around, but it basically, it shows the thought process of its responses. So instead of you typing in a question and you getting an answer, DeepSeek will actually show you how it gets to that answer. So it'll say, oh, the user asked me about this question, and I'm thinking if I should cover this or that. So I think that feature, even though DeepSeek didn't invent it, it integrated it into its product in a really user-friendly way. And it really makes users trust the AI a lot more. And I think it's led to its virality. It's a big reason for its virality, basically.
It's kind of thinking out loud, right? And letting you participate in that. So it almost feels like you've begun this parasocial relationship with R1.
That's exactly right. And I think what we've seen from ChatGPT and other AI chatbots is that when they act more human, humans like that more. Mm-hmm. So it really works.
Yeah, and they tend to trust it more. So, you know, it's like the answer must be right because the bot told me how it tried to get there, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that's part of the problem with the censorship is that, you know, you don't really know. even you might trust it from the reasoning, but the reasoning is just, it's not actually thinking, to be clear. This is just a kind of AI, it's part of the technology of AI, and OpenAI uses it as well. They just don't show it as much until recently. So yeah.
There's been in the headlines when this came out, there was a lot of conversation about the cost of development and the energy efficiency behind DeepSeek and R1. Has that panned out and turned out to be true? What do we know about that?
That's a great question. And so this is a major reason why R1 and DeepSeek went so viral is there's this kind of David versus Goliath story that DeepSeek is this Chinese company that's subject to strict U.S. export controls on chips. And despite that, they put out a world-beating AI model. And the truth behind that is more complicated. The big figure floating around was that their R1 model cost only $5.6 million, but that's not accurate. That figure is actually for a previous model, and it's only partial. So, in fact, DeepSeek itself has complained, the founder of DeepSeek has actually complained that the one constraint on his company is access to chips. So it's not actually clear that DeepSeek's success means there will not be any demand for advanced chips anymore. I do think that we're still trying to figure that out. And the truth is that currently no one really knows exactly how many chips DeepSeek has.
And that's just to back up for listeners who may not understand that is that, you know, to do the kind of processing that artificial intelligence requires means that we need the kind of computer chips that can make these calculations quickly, efficiently, which is why I think chip companies like NVIDIA and Broadcom were having a wonderful time on the stock market in terms of their price. But they kind of suffered last week.
Yeah, they suffered big. I mean, on Monday, NVIDIA dropped almost 20%, which is just massive, hundreds of billions of dollars in value. And a lot of that was attributed to DeepSeek's R1 model and the idea that they really, all this fancy AI stuff can be done on far less chips. NVIDIA stock has since recovered a big part of that. And I think now there's a debate in Silicon Valley about whether this will really mean there will be lower demand for AI chips. Another part of that conversation is that as more people use AI, because of the cheaper price of compute, basically, probably this will drive even more people to use it. And so what they call inference might rise. So to be honest, it's quite fuzzy whether this will actually result in lower chip demand or not.
Mm. Well, I thought this was rather ironic. In the words of Alanis Morissette, OpenAI is saying that it has evidence that DeepSeek used its model to train DeepSeek's platform. And there's been so much criticism about OpenAI scraping authors' works and trying to, in a not fair way, use other people's voices in training its own app. So what do we know about that? Did DeepSeek use OpenAI code or processes?
Yeah, it is. A lot of people are commenting on that irony. And so far, it's still early. Basically, what we do know is that Microsoft has handed some kind of evidence to OpenAI that this might have happened, and they're investigating. There is some circumstantial evidence that this has been the case. For example, if you ask some users who have asked DeepSeek, what model are you? It respond, I'm an OpenAI model.
Well, maybe DeepSeek is deeply honest.
Maybe a little too honest, but to be clear, that's still circumstantial because these models all train on a lot of public data and it's still unclear whether that's the case.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've spent a few months worrying about a TikTok problem. That is that the Chinese government may own the Dance Byte, the company that runs TikTok, in a way that's problematic. Tell us a little bit about the ownership of DeepSeek and whether there's a TikTok situation here.
I think that could very likely happen. So DeepSeek in some ways is a more direct threat, according to some, to the U.S. National security. That's mainly because TikTok does say, like, you know, we're they say we're a Singapore company. You know, they do try to create distance between China and the TikTok U.S. data. With DeepSeek, the connection is totally there and it's out in the open. DeepSeek's privacy policy explicitly states that the data basically your data is going to China and it's governed under Chinese law. And Chinese law has very broad permissions for data to be used by authorities, including intelligence agencies. So there is a clear risk there, some people are pointing out, and it remains to be seen what will happen. And I would not be surprised if there were restrictions coming along, and we're already seeing that happen in government, but it might spread.
Well, I mean, yes, as you said, many U.S. government agencies and companies have blocked the use of DeepSeek with their clients, and Taiwan and Italy have also put some restrictions on that. Has the U.S. government said anything about this?
The U.S. government has, and in fact, some David Sachs, a Donald Trump advisor, has called out DeepSeek for allegedly copying OpenAI. So there is some scrutiny on DeepSeek already. And I think Trump has also called for the US to see this as a kind of revitalization moment of like increased competition. And in that, there has been a strong framing of this as part of a AI race between China and the US, and that the US needs to beat China in this competition, basically. Mm.
Right. So we're having an AI war now. I mean, last couple of questions. I mean, the Bay Area, San Francisco in particular, has put a lot of chips on this idea that the AI industry will help revitalize its economy. How concerned are city leaders and business leaders about this type of competition?
I think there was a lot of concern on Monday when NVIDIA's stock crashed by almost 20%. But I do think, having listened to some earnings calls, for example, Meta actually pledged to really double down on their AI investments. And they kind of shrugged off DeepSeek, and they said they would spend hundreds of billions of dollars on AI in the coming years. So I think there has been a stabilization from the panic of last week, but it still remains to be seen how it'll all play out.
Well, we'll have to wait and see, as you said, to see what happens and learn about what is going to happen next. Well, thank you, Charles Rollet, senior reporter at TechCrunch, for joining us here on State of the Bay.
Thanks a lot.
Up next, we'll hear about how the Trump administration's new immigration policies are affecting Bay Area residents. Stay with us.
Tune into Cross Currents tomorrow morning at 11 in Encampment Sweeps on how folks can lose their belongings, including vital medications and documents.
The idea is, well, we want people to hold on to their medication and not take that away because you need that to survive. But I asked the city for any records of these policies, and they were unable to produce a single acknowledgement.
The efficacy of San Francisco's bag and tag policy. That's tomorrow morning at 11 on Cross Currents from KALW News.
On the next Your Calls One Planet series, we'll discuss a joint investigation by The Guardian and Quinto Elemento Lab that reveals how U.S. companies are exporting their hazardous industrial waste to Mexico and Canada, leaving our neighboring countries with all the health and environmental consequences. U.S. companies are exporting over 1 million tons of hazardous waste annually, most of which is going to Mexico and Canada. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Ethan Elkind, and you.
And that will be tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock for Your Call. Actually, that will be a rebroadcast of this morning's Your Call, and that will be tonight at 7 o'clock with Ethan Elkind here on 91.7 FM and KLW.org.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan. In a slew of executive actions targeting immigration, Donald Trump has called for mass deportations, troops at the border, and funds to build a wall. In response, courts have put a pause on some of his orders, including his constitutionally questionable quest to end birthright citizenship, but other orders still stand. And today, across the country, businesses shut down in protest, calling it a day without immigrants. Tonight, we're discussing how Trump's policies are impacting life in the Bay Area for immigrants, both documented and undocumented, and we're going to look at how local advocates are responding. We'll also explore what Bay Area residents need to know and where people can turn to for help. Tonight, joining me are Max Harrison Caldwell. He's the Express Desk reporter at the San Francisco Standard. Welcome to State of the Bay, Max.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Catherine Seitz, the legal director at the Immigration Institute of the Bay Area. That's an organization which offers critical legal services, education, and civic engagement opportunities to immigrants. Thanks for joining us tonight, Catherine.
Thank you for having us.
We also have Sanika Mahajan. She's the Director of Community Engagement and Organizing at Mission Action, a local grassroots group that empowers local low-income and immigrant communities. Welcome, Sanika.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And State of the Bay listeners, we're opening up the phone lines early tonight to hear from you. How have Trump's new immigration policies affected you or someone you know? And are you concerned about what these changes might mean for loved ones, friends, or family, or your community? You can give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or send us a message on X at State of the Bay or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org. And we love your emails, so send those in. Catherine, I just wanted to start with you to get us all on the same page. I mentioned a few of Trump's executive orders on immigration that grabbed headlines when they were first issued. Give us a really quick update on what Trump has outlined and where those orders stand.
Okay. Yeah, it's a little overwhelming to keep up. There's at one point we counted up to 89 actions or orders of some sort. Relating to immigration. So the one you mentioned already, birthright citizenship, was sort of the most dramatic one, since that's based on case law that's over 100 years old. But another one is under the previous administration, in order to stop people crossing the border without permission, they had set up a system of parole programs and this app that you could use at the border to make an appointment to be screened if you wanted to seek asylum at the southern border. And all of those programs have been canceled. So now there's no legal way for or lawful way for an asylum seeker to try to access asylum either from abroad or at the southern border. They've also stopped refugee resettlement, and they stopped it suddenly. Like, people were on flights or ready to get on flights to come here with approved refugee documents, and they were told, no, it's too late, you can't come. They've reinstated or ordered the reinstatement of Remain in Mexico, which is where once they do start allowing people to seek asylum, they'll have to wait in Mexico for their hearing, which is just very problematic in many ways. It's not safe for people to wait there. And then how do they keep track of their hearings, and how do they get access to attorneys to represent them? There's just huge problems with that, and we saw that last time. And then a big scary one is that they've ordered the expansion of expedited removal, and that's something that is traditionally just used at the border. So if you're coming in at the border and you're caught, you might be just processed right there and deported back to your home country immediately without access to an immigration judge. But now they want to expand that to the whole country for anybody who's been here less than 2 years. And that's really scary, because that cuts off an important right for people to get their cases heard.
Mm. And I mean, they also, as we heard earlier, they're changing the temporary protected status of certain immigrants who are here under, the United States has said it's okay for you to be here, and they're changing that as well. For listeners who may not know what that is, can you explain that, Catherine?
Yeah, temporary protected status is a way that if there's something happening in a big group of people's home country where it's not a good idea for them to go back, either there's political unrest or violence, or there was, a natural disaster or something. It's a way that the people who are already here in the U.S. at the time that happened can be granted a work permit and permission to stay here. And so it gives them a chance to earn money here, be stable, send money home for the rebuilding of their country. There's a lot of countries that have benefited from this, and Venezuela is one of them because of the ongoing repression and political unrest there under the Maduro regime. So they just recently announced they're canceling the most recent extension of Venezuelan TPS.
These are things that Trump ran on. These are part of his campaign promises. And Catherine, just staying for you for a moment, was your organization preparing for this? I mean, did anything about these orders surprise you?
No. The only thing that sort of has surprised me this time is the, I guess it didn't surprise me, but is the threats of massive detention and massive deportation, right? They're talking about using military bases and reopening Guantanamo to house immigration detainees, people who haven't necessarily been committed any crime or anything, or just trying to get to safety and get to the United States. So that's sort of a little bit of a surprise, but no, otherwise we were here through Trump 1.0. I can't tell you how many meetings I had about Trump 2.0, as people were calling it, to the point where my anxiety was off the charts on election day. So it's not surprising, unfortunately. It's just super sad and super mean. It's just so harmful to people to make everybody so afraid.
Well, Sonika Mahajan, your organization, Mission Action, focuses on assisting immigrant communities. And I wanted you to describe the feelings that people are having. Like, what are you seeing and experiencing as someone who's trying to assist that community?
We're based primarily in the Mission District in San Francisco, and we serve the immigrant communities around the city. We've definitely heard a lot of fear and confusion regarding both the ICE raids that have already happened and also potential ones that people fear might be coming down the pipeline. And there's already been an increase in those arrests in the past couple of weeks compared to any month last year. Mm-hmm. But that is something that's very intentional and isn't surprising to us, as Catherine mentioned. It's something that the right wing is doing on purpose. It's a tactic being used to try to divide us, divide immigrants from each other, divide the working class from each other. So there's also a great deal of interest in fighting back, and there's a really great outpouring of interest, people ready to mobilize against these right-wing attacks, readiness to resist, really. And I think we know the winds of the immigrant community in the Bay Area have been really hard fought, not something that anyone has given to us, politicians or others. So I'm also hearing a lot of solo el pueblo salva el pueblo, which means only the people can save the people. And I think people are really ready to fight back. There's not only an outpouring of volunteer engagement, but also organizations banding together in broad-based coalition to really combat not only attacks on immigrants, but all of these right-wing attacks.
Max Harrison Caldwell, I mean, as Sonika mentioned, there are ICE raids that are happening. And in these initial days, once the orders were announced, the communities have been on edge. And, there have been some rumors that have turned out to be true and some that have not turned out to be true about ICE raids. Tell us a little bit about that and what you've reported on.
Sure. So in Trump's first week in office, there was a rumor that an ICE agent had approached a middle school student on a Muni bus. Now, this turned out not to be true, but it took about 24 hours for city officials to debunk the rumor. And by that time, it had spread really widely, inspired panic across the city among these vulnerable people and their loved ones. And everybody was already on edge, and it just contributed to that. Now, there was one arrest in San Francisco that we know of during the first week of Trump's presidency, but it was a targeted arrest of a man who had been convicted of sexual assault, as reported by NBC. That's not unprecedented. ICE has been doing targeted arrests with warrants in San Francisco for years. The city's sanctuary city status does not preclude that. What is new is that ICE agents showed up at a series of downtown office buildings that same week where undocumented janitors were working, and they didn't have warrants. They were denied entry and made no arrests. But that's something that we haven't seen as much of.
Well, last week, Max, the San Francisco Board of Supervisors reaffirmed that San Francisco remains a sanctuary city. What does that mean exactly?
Yeah, there was a press conference on Tuesday where every city supervisor and the mayor and the district attorney and the city attorney and a number of other officials came out to declare their support for the sanctuary city policy. What it means is that ICE cannot deputize local law enforcement agents in ICE operations. So they can't come in and say, hey, Chief Scott, we need 20 police officers to work for us on this operation. Now, local law enforcement still cannot interfere with or impede ICE operations in the city. And there are specific cases still where they will share information with them. For example, the district attorney's office has handed off cases against people accused of selling fentanyl to federal authorities. Now, they don't share the suspect's immigration status, but they do share other information. Also, the sheriff, Paul Miyamoto, at the press conference last week said that despite the sanctuary city status, there are specific cases in which the sheriff's office will share information about inmates with ICE before those inmates are released. This is when ICE already has warrants for people that happen to be in San Francisco city jails.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a tricky balance. You know, San Francisco does receive federal monies and relies on that in some part. With Daniel Lurie specifically, how is he handling that balance of making sure that he says, you know, he has said this is a sanctuary city, but also not upsetting the federal tiger that could, you know, keep funds from the city?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I'm glad that I'm not on his team and in charge of figuring that out. He's been pretty quiet so far. You know, he came out at the press conference last week on the city hall steps and declared that he would fight for immigrants. But we haven't really seen too much from him so far. I at least am not sure what's going on in his policy discussions right now on this issue.
Mm. Yeah, Catherine, are there other sanctuary cities in the Bay Area, and do the policies differ from city to city?
I think most cities in the Bay Area are sanctuary cities, and the policies are sort of very basic in the same way that San Francisco is, that they don't allow their police or other officials to cooperate with ICE. And it's really important because this is very protective for victims of crime. So if somebody is undocumented and in an abusive relationship, a lot of times their abuser will say, you can't call the police on me when I'm abusing you, because if you do, they're just going to arrest you and deport you. And so there's a lot of fear. So it's really important that police get that message out that they're not cooperating with ICE, that in fact it is safe to call them, and in fact beneficial to call them, because there's avenues to work permits and green cards eventually if you're a victim of crime and you cooperate with law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, is there a California state law about sanctuary?
There is. There's the California Trust Act, which stops jails and prisons from holding people on ICE holds, but there's lots of exceptions where if they've been convicted of felonies or certain misdemeanors, they won't be held, but ICE will be allowed in and will be communicated, so ICE can just pick them up at the time of release.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so these sanctuary laws really do address, I mean, a lot of people have maybe a misplaced concern about crime and undocumented mm-hmm. immigrants, but it, as you've described them, both Catherine Max and Sonica, I mean, these are sanctuary laws that have exceptions for when a crime has actually been committed. Isn't that right, Catherine?
Yeah, mm-hmm. That is right. And in many ways, sanctuary laws reduce crime because it helps support victims in feeling safe to report crime.
Mm. Sonica, the Trump administration has said that it feels that it has the authority to go into schools and churches. I don't know if that's unprecedented, but how is your community, your organization, thinking through that? And will it matter if San Francisco is a sanctuary city, if ICE feels free to be able to go into schools?
I think the most important thing that we need to do to respond to rhetoric like that is to empower our community with the knowledge that they have rights and that they have power, right? Just regardless of your documentation status, there are certain rights that everyone living here can evoke. And so we're spending a lot of time with our community and a lot of volunteers and staff in immigration nonprofits like ours across the city, handing out thousands of red cards that let people know their rights in multiple languages. Let them know they can stay silent, that they don't have to provide any documentation, that ICE cannot enter a building of any kind if they don't have a warrant signed by a judge. And oftentimes, they don't have a warrant signed by a judge, and they're trying to trick or intimidate people into thinking that they have the authority to enter when they don't. So we're trying our best to empower our staff, our community, school sites, churches, and other faith communities, and businesses as well, everyone that we can, to have that information. And as you know, we also have a 24/7 hotline staffed in multiple languages as well that people should call if they believe they're witnessing any kind of ICE activity or arrest, mm-hmm. And try to take documentation as safely as they can so we can help verify that, because we want to get out accurate information to our community, not spread any rumors or misinformation, so people know what's actually happening and can respond accordingly.
Sonika, can I stop you there? I mean, what is the number that people should call?
Great question. It's 415-200-1548.
You want to say that one more time?
Yeah, 415-200-1548.
Well, we're talking about immigration, Trump's immigration orders, and how they're affecting us in the Bay Area. And we'd love to hear from you, our State of the Bay listeners. This is State of the Bay, 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area, and I'm Grace Wan. So we're opening up our phone lines and we're taking your comments. How are you metabolizing these new immigration policies from the Trump administration? Are you concerned about what these changes might mean for you or a loved one or somebody in your community? Or just what questions do you have? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, or send us an email at stateofthebay@kalw.org. We have a question here. How can people on different visa statuses, like student or work visas, stay informed about changes that might affect their ability to remain here? Catherine?
Well, one way is to come and get a consultation, either with any of the Bay Area nonprofits or with a private immigration attorney. We have offices throughout the Bay Area. We have 7 offices around the Bay Area, and our website is www.iibayarea.org. So you can go on the website, and for most of our offices, you can self-schedule right there and get a consultation, because if people are worried about their status, they should talk to an immigration attorney or an accredited representative and get good information and good advice about what they can do and if there's any steps they can do to maintain their status or even move on to a more permanent status.
Mm. You know, Max, we were talking earlier about how the Trump administration uses the power of the federal purse as a sword and the balancing that city leaders are having to do with these immigration orders. I mean, Governor Newsom did also convene the state legislature to, you know, Trump-proof California. Are any of those funds coming to the city, or are there any ways that the state is helping the cities and municipalities kind of gird themselves for immigration actions?
Good question. I do not know the details of how the state funding is going to help us in this case. What I can say is that we desperately need it, all the funds we can get. I mean, you know, I've been speaking with undocumented people over the last few weeks who are just afraid to even be in public. I talked to a guy who is a restaurant worker. He's been in San Francisco for 17 years. And he said he used to love going out to eat. He reinvests all the money he earns in the local economy. He would go to clubs at night, and now he just goes straight home from work because he says anytime he's out in the streets, he's worried about running into an ICE agent and getting arrested. Mm. So if there's any state money that we can use to better assure our residents here in San Francisco, it'll be well spent.
When you hear something like that, Sonika, I mean, it sounds familiar, I'm sure, to a lot of your clients. I mean, today was a day in which several businesses closed because it was a day without immigrants. I mean, remind us how the immigrant population, both documented and undocumented, fuels our local economy.
Absolutely. Immigrants are workers, right? Especially in San Francisco, immigrants are the janitors cleaning our buildings. They're day laborers, domestic workers. A lot of them are working at nonprofits like mine. Some of them are working in tech companies. Without immigrants, our economy doesn't run. And in the early 2000s, there were days without immigrants where in San Francisco, 200,000 people marched and several businesses had to shut down. Immigrants and allies didn't go to work and school. And we saw how city economies can grind to a halt without immigrants involved in them. And so I think it just also highlights how if the ultra-rich right wing that Trump represents wants to continue attacking immigrants, it's actually their labor that people like him are profiting from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, Catherine, I mean, during the first Trump administration, as you said, you know, we saw a lot of these policies, and Trump was successful in some and not successful in others. I mean, he was going to build a wall, and I think he only managed to build 100 miles of it in the end. What do you think is the most dangerous thing right now that we should be keeping our attention to? Because there's, as you said, there are 89 orders. It's hard to keep focused on what that most important thing is. I mean, we all have limited time and energy. So what should we be focused on?
I think one of the sort of the scariest things will be if they expand detention to people who are in the process, sort of people who've already applied for something. Because normally, like the kind of work that we do, we think of it as deportation prevention, because we're helping a domestic violence survivor apply for a U visa, or we're helping somebody who maybe overstayed their visa, but now they're married to a US citizen. We're helping them apply for a green card. And normally those sorts of folks don't have to worry about being detained, you know, or somebody who has DACA. They don't usually have to worry about being detained. But the big fear, I think, is that this detention will start impacting those sorts of people, or people with asylum cases pending, so that people will give up on their case because they're so the conditions in detention are so bad that they'll just give up and leave.
I mean, it seems like a underlying theme of these orders, because some of them are just on their face not constitutional, right? And like at some level, somebody in that administration must know, like, this isn't going to pass. Like, birthright citizenship is probably going to be birthright citizenship. But there seems to be both, like, the desire to sow fear and also, you know, I think it's fair to say racism that's embedded in these. So when you talk to immigrants who work hard, and I believe immigrants often, even the undocumented immigrants, pay taxes and they're paying into a system, but they don't get to get Social Security, even though they pay those kinds of taxes. How do they feel? I mean, Sonika?
Yeah. I mean, as I mentioned, there is fear and there is confusion, but I think there's a lot of indignation as well, and anger, and an understanding now that we as immigrants have power because we're contributing, just like you said, to this country, to the city and state and national economies. And so there's really a readiness to connect all of these struggles together, right? Immigrants know that we are under attack and our communities are under attack, but it's not just immigrants. A lot of these executive orders are also going to attack organized labor. They're also going to attack education, women, queer people, LGBTQ people. So I think there's more and more, especially in the second version of the Trump administration, a readiness to start connecting all of those fights within the immigrant community and start seeing how the struggle for immigrant defense is also connected to all of these other fights. And, you know, although there's fear, there's also organization. I think that's our best bet to fighting back. At Mission Action, we're involved in multiple coalitions that are banding together unions, healthcare workers, grassroots organizations, nonprofits. And we've been meeting every Friday to have massive public organizing meetings every Friday at 7 p.m. They're usually at the Oakland Liberation Center. And we're able to bring together not only these organizations, including immigrants, but also hundreds of volunteers who are ready to defend our immigrants, who understand the power of sanctuary cities in the Bay Area, whether they're documented or undocumented. And I think that's like the biggest thing that I want people to take away from this, is that, yes, absolutely, the Trump administration is trying to sow fear. They're using this flood the zone strategy to throw as much at us as possible, but we're not backing down. We're making all these connections and getting ready to fight together.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that. I mean, during the first Trump administration, it felt like there was a lot more outrage. I mean, he announced, for example, that there was going to be a Muslim ban, and that brought people to the airports, including the Google founder Sergey Brin, who, you know, this time around was front and center at the Trump inauguration. Max, has the Bay Area attitude towards protest changed?
Well, we will be seeing a protest this Wednesday at Mission and 24th Street. I just saw a flyer for it today. We've, of course, seen the protests in Los Angeles as well. I think give people a little bit of time. Right now, there was an initial shell shock. The Mission District was really quiet for a few days. I spoke with store clerks and restaurant workers who said they had seen a decline in business because people were just afraid to leave their homes. Now, I think people are organizing more, and we're going to see more demonstration, more organized resistance in the streets.
We have another listener question. I'm worried about a good friend and her family who don't have legal status nor a criminal record. What is their risk of deportation? What legal pathways remain to immigration? Catherine?
Yeah, there are still many pathways to immigration, you know, to get status. And so you should advise that that friend to get a consultation with a reputable immigration nonprofit like IIBA or with a private immigration attorney so that they can find out if they have a way. Sometimes people just don't realize, you know, sometimes some family member has petitioned them, or they've been a victim of a crime and they cooperated, or there's some other way that they can get status. But even if there isn't a way, we can also talk to them about giving them that Know Your Rights information and making sure that they know that if ICE comes to their house, they can keep the door closed. And if they get picked up by ICE, they have the right to ask for a hearing with an immigration judge.
Well, Catherine, with the time that we have left, why don't you give out the website address of your organization again?
Yeah, it's iibayarea.org.
Great.
So it's Immigration Institute of the Bay Area.
And Sonica, I wanted you to give us your number, the number again. Is that a 24/7 hotline?
It is 24/7 and in multiple languages. It's 415-200-1548.
One more time.
415-200-1548. And actually, it'd be great to follow us on Instagram for updates as well, at Mission Action SF.
And what about that protest on Wednesday? Are you all participating in that?
We are, yeah. We'll be a co-sponsor of that protest along with several other organizations, and we're excited to hit the streets.
Yeah, and is it going to be a march, or tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, so we're starting at 24th and Mission, and I think really being in the heart of the Mission is important here because we know that that's where so much immigrant resistance has happened in San Francisco and the Bay Area. No more details yet, but I think that the more people that come out, the better it'll be.
Do you have a time?
5:30 on Wednesday.
5:30 on Wednesday. Well, we've just scratched the surface of this topic, and I know we'll be talking about it more soon, and we're going to have to leave it there for tonight. My guests have been Max Harrison Caldwell, Express Desk reporter at the San Francisco Standard. Thanks for joining us, Max.
Thanks so much, Grace.
Catherine Seitz, the legal director at the Immigration Institute of the Bay Area. Thanks so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
And here in the studio, Sonica Mahajan. She's the Director of Community Engagement and Organizing at Mission Action. Thanks, Sonica.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for joining us here on State of the Bay. Coming up after the break, local author Jenna Ann Miller. Stay tuned.
This week on This American Life.
So he's moving now. The guy in the white car's moving. Bob's moving. You'll all be able to put your cars right down there.
On a narrow street in Brooklyn, one neighbor takes it on himself to get everybody to move their cars two times a week when the street cleaner comes through. You know what? He does this week in, week out. We hear about that and about other people who choose to live in their own ever-repeating Groundhog Days. For Groundhog Day, this week.
This American Life, tomorrow afternoon at 4 o'clock here on 91.7 FM and at 5.
The Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel and unusual punishment.
At least one person during the discussions of the Eighth Amendment said, well, what does this mean exactly?
There was other people who said it would have been ridiculous, essentially, to categorize all the different punishments that were considered cruel and unusual at that time.
That's on the next Throughline from NPR.
Tomorrow afternoon at 5 o'clock on 91.7 FM and KALW.org, along with the KALW app.
We're doing fine.
If your spouse woke up from a coma with the mind of a child, what would you do? That's the premise of local author Jenna Ann Miller's memoir, The Phenom's Wife. From the immediate horror of seeing her husband on life support to his unexpected survival and the upheaval that follows, Jenna faces her family's nightmare with grace, love, and gratitude, all while finding purpose in tragedy. The Phenom's Wife is Jenna's debut book, and we're thrilled to have her here with us today. Jenna, welcome to State of the Bay.
Thank you so much, Fred. It's so lovely to be here.
So who is the phenom and what is his story?
So my husband got hit by a car back in 2017 while cycling, and he fell into a coma. His brain injury was so massive that no one thought he'd survive. And in many ways, he didn't. So we came home from the hospital with this body of a 95-year-old and the mind of a 7-year-old. It was like having a baby who could text an Uber. I mean, think about that. Terrifying. But what was crazy, and I don't know how this happened, but I wasn't angry. I wasn't resentful. I felt honored to take care of this man 24/7. Like, the reason I think in part that I felt so honored to care for him is I believed in him. I believed he was going to have a full recovery. And as crazy as that sounds, once you find out about who my husband was before this accident, you could maybe agree with me too. So back in 2006, Steve, who was already a cyclist, decided to try a new sport, track cycling. By 2007, he was racing center stage on the World Cup to qualify for the Beijing Olympics.
Wow.
Like, who is this guy? Who does that, right? So I'm thinking to myself, okay, if there is anybody who can get themselves out of this mess, it's my husband, Steve Pelletz. But back in 2006, this racing blog that he's posting, but of course I never read it. I accidentally discover that blog when he's in a coma. And it's like a lifeline for me because I can hear his voice. I literally felt like he was telling me how he was going to use his physical and mental athletic prowess and his, you know, tendency to beat impossible odds to get him out of this horrific situation we were in. In that blog, Steve called another athlete a phenom. So when Steve woke up from his coma, I'd said, you are the phenom. So my husband, he has a massive brain injury. The doctors are saying we don't know what he's going to be if he wakes up. And what's crazy is this is the worst time of my life. I'm leveled to the ground. And at the same time, I am bursting with gratitude and hope. I was in this paradox where I had rallied this blog community that created what I can only describe as a field of magic, if you will. Like, I wished for something and it showed up on my front porch. Steve is getting kicked out of the hospital and a blog reader happens to know the CEO of our billion-dollar insurance company and fixes the problem. I felt like I had a genie in a bottle. So it was this whole idea that I'm in the worst time of my life and weirdly kind of the best, right? This magic is happening and synchronicities are spilling and I feel loved and I feel held all at the same time. So I want to share all of that and the beauty of all of that. But then there's also all these other layers to the story. There's how our family faced trauma, our spiritual journey, Steve's journey recovering from traumatic brain injury, navigating health insurance, oh boy, health care, a whole other thing. I mean, it even has humor, but especially it even has a sex scene, Brett.
Ooh, do you want to expand on the sex scene for our listeners or?
I guess. Okay, so at this point, Steve had been in the hospital for 111 days. And his internal medicine doctor walks into the hospital room and says, oh, I'm so glad it's just the two of you. He says, we need to talk. Do you know I'm also a sex doctor? And I'm like, no, what is going on, Dr. Moser? He says, Steve, you told one of the medical staff members that she's hot. Oh, Steve's face turns white. His eyes pop out of his face. He's like guilty as charged and terrified at the same time. And Steve's response is, do you have a pill for that? You know, he's taking like 13 pills. And Dr. Moser says, well, I have something else in mind. And he writes a prescription for something that I did not know could be prescribed. You'll have to read the book for the 50 Shades of Grey chapter.
Nice. One of the things that's most impressive in your story is the incredible grace, the kindness, forgiveness, which you handled everything. If I recall correctly, the police met you in the waiting room of the ER shortly after you got to the hospital. And the first question after hearing the horrible story of your husband's accident was from you, oh, the poor girl who hit him, how is she? I mean, how did you find grace and love in the midst of all that tragedy?
That's such a really good question. I think it's because I had what people have told me is a trauma-induced spiritual awakening. And as soon as I got that call from the hospital, I just felt washed in love. I don't know how to explain it. It was like this feeling came over me. And that was the foundation for how I was going to live my new life.
As you sewed together all these blog entries, what was one of the hardest memories you can share?
So Steve had been in a coma for a month and he wasn't responding to commands. 2 weeks before the accident, he had resigned from his job and accepted a new job at Salesforce. And so I realized, oh my gosh, he's going to be unemployed in a matter of days and without benefits. So I asked both companies what we should do. To my shock, Salesforce offered to hire Steve in a coma so he could have benefits. And Financial Force, his old company, said, no, we will take him back so he can remain with his existing coverage. I was blown out of the water.
Right.
I emailed both CEOs of these two companies, thanking them for their generosity. I never in a million years thought Mark Benioff of Salesforce would email me back. He did. And he gave me a slew of contacts to help our family, including this famous neurosurgeon named Dr. Jeff Manley. I'm thinking this is our golden ticket. Dr. Manley is going to save Steve. I get the call and it's nothing of what I expected. He basically said to me, he said, I talked to Dr. Stoudemire and all of the folks who are taking care of Steve, and we all agree his outlook is ominous. So I felt shattered. And I began to cry right there at the hospital in front of our 13-year-old son. I went home and I pleaded with the blog. I said, please, this is what happened today. Please help me. Please help me bring Steve back to life. And truly, it was a Horton here's a who moment because I felt like every who from Whoville came far and wide to my plea for help. I mean, seriously, dozens of blog comments are pouring in. Readers are coming from every direction. I walk into the hospital and Steve is unequivocally responding to commands for the first time. I am floored.
How's Steve doing now?
I am no longer his primary caregiver. We talk every day. He says he's happy and there's a hole in his heart because he's not with his family.
Right.
His children are in college. I'm not his caregiver. So he's missing that. It's tough and it's okay. And that's kind of the truth for all four of us, to be honest.
Wow. What do you hope people take away from your story?
I think it's that whole idea that life is not black and white, that joy and pain can coexist, that it's not about fixing life and making it all better. It's about handling what you've got and facing it with truth and love and vulnerability. Those are sort of the saving graces for me.
Well, I think at that point, we are out of time. I'd love to keep talking, but if you anyone out there would like to pick up a copy of The Phenom's Wife, you can find it on Amazon or have it ordered to any independent bookstore. If you'd like to meet the author, Jenna, in person and get a signed copy, she'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera, February 23rd at 4 p.m. Jenna, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Fred.
Well, that's State of the Bay this week. We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation. Next Monday at 6, we'll be talking to the director of a new documentary, Underdogs. It's about a group of prisoners and a pack of rescue dogs and how they end up saving each other. For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on kalw.org. And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. You can email us at any time at stateofthebay@kalw.org. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and Jillian Emblad. It was engineered by David Kwan, and the fantastic D Minor was our board operator. I'm Grace Wan. Good night, and thanks for listening.